Okay, well, thank you, Andrew, for that fascinating talk. Of course, we agree with the conclusion, but to give your voice a rest, we'll have kind of pass around the collection, which will go towards fighting and working for a new society. And I can also pass around a mailing list for anybody who wants to be kept informed of other meetings here. And also, as I said, I'll repeat this again, we've got various pamphlets and leaflets on sale. We've got a copy of the Socialist Standard, the current issue, which, as it happens, contains an article called The Underwhelming Theory of Underconsumption. And we've also got an interview which we did with Andrew Kleinman in last year, I think, which is also on sale over there. But so we can come back to this at the end of the meeting as those things. Anyway, I think we should probably start off with technical questions. Any part you didn't, you didn't understand. Has anybody got any particular question to Andrew about what he says? Then we can have discussion.
I would also welcome comments.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Well, let's not bother with it. Anyway, who wants to kick off with a question or a comment? Yes, Peter.
Hi. Thank you for a very interesting talk. You said after the war was a golden age of capitalism, I believe. If you're a capitalist, it was the worst period to be a capitalist during that period, because the governments across the world were putting very heavy regulation on the capitalist men and women. So I don't quite understand that statement of yours. And also, economic crisis and financial crisis. I don't really agree with these terms, because they sound like a natural act that's happening, where I sort of see it as a deliberate way of controlling the masses and introducing horrendous crimes of stealing vast amounts of money from countries, the recession. And I wouldn't use those terms, economic crisis, because it does allude to something that doesn't describe what happens. So I would use a term like economic global rape of the working class, which has much more realistic a definition, and also gives people an understanding of even people not even interested in economics would understand that phrase, because it has a conclusion to it and its own definition. And I don't think capitalism is just about profit. It is about world governance, governing the world through horrendous economic pressures it puts on governments through debt and other horrendous acts which it puts upon our societies across the world and people across the world. Thank you very much.
Ready to answer that then?
We do them one at a time?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I first of all said so-called golden age. I mean, it's a term of art. I don't particularly like it. But there are a few facts. By every measure that I know, and I would agree with this, the rate of profit coming out of World War II was, much higher than before, which was the Depression. And after, the rate of profit has fallen, so it was high. The rate of economic growth was very high. Other things like that. So compared to both before and after, there's something very particular about the recovery coming out of World War II in the U.S., in Europe. The term... I don't like to actually refer to recessions and downturns as crises. I like to refer to them as recessions and so forth, but there's sort of like this Marxist terminology. It was not Marx's terminology. Marx, he talked about financial crises and commercial crises, but he didn't, he would refer to the recession as a decline or stagnation. Okay, but financial crisis is a term of art, okay? It's been there. That was a term in Marx's day. It's again a term used in the business press. I don't think a crisis is naturally a natural act, but I definitely do not agree that what we've had is a deliberate way of controlling the masses, although that has been a response. Nobody wanted the Great Recession. They did not plan the Great Recession. If you look at the facts, they have been very unhappy, and it's their system. And, you know, in September, October 2008, its fate was hanging in the balance. And as I mentioned, between 2007 and 2009, the tax return income of the top 1% of tax units in the United States fell by more than a third. You can't tell me that the very rich wanted that to happen, okay? And I think that we have to, you know, get away from the idea of conspiracies, although sometimes there are. Marx was greatly appreciative of something in classical economics that I think we need to get back to, which is this idea of unintended consequences. This is not a planned system. Capitalism cannot be a planned system. And it does not work in anybody's interest. There are processes, laws that arise through the interaction of people and businesses and so forth. And what happens, the effects are not necessarily planned. Now, in, you know, bourgeois thinking, these unintended consequences are always, you know, wonderful. The invisible hand of Adam Smith, you know. Nobody's trying to promote the general good, but through their greed, they're making everything better for everybody. Marx is very aware of unintended consequences. Capitalists, for instance, invest in machinery, you know, mechanized production. They're trying to boost their profitability. But what happens at the level of society, that creates a tendency for the rate of profit to fall. I think we need to be very well aware of those things. So I would not say there was no, you know, Great Recession, financial crisis, economic crisis, and stuff like that. You also said capitalism is not just about profit. It's also about, I guess you were like imposing debt conditions and stuff is what you had in mind, right?
Sorry, yes.
Yeah. But why does like the Troika, you know, put heavy pressure, you know, for repayment of debt? That's about profitability. Okay. One very important thing is, you know, why they are so reluctant to say to Greece, okay, you don't have to pay your debts. If this were to ever become a principle that if you can't pay your debts, it's okay that you don't have to pay your debts, where would capitalism be? You know, it would be good for people. Yeah, it doesn't make sense in Greece's case. They can't pay back the debt and everybody knows it. But if you say, okay, that's fine, do over, you know, we'll wipe the slate clean, that's just a signal nobody's got to repay their debts. You can't have capitalism that works like that. So it is all about profit.
You had a question?
Oh, you see me. You've spoken quite a lot about America, and I think the same thing would apply to Western Europe as well. I wondered if you could say something about China and the effects of recession on China and the implications for that.
Right. It's hard to know much about China. The statistics are managed. From what I know, it's hard to know. But I looked at the changes in the growth rates of a lot of different countries, like the biggest economies and China, which is now one of them. And, you know, economic growth did not decline in China. Okay, so that's to say they're producing more year after year instead of less, which has happened like in the UK, the US, France, and so forth. But if you look at the change in the growth rate, the percentage fall in China was not small. Okay, so it went down from like 12 to 7, 12 to 8. Okay, going down from 12 to 7 is comparable to going down from 3 to minus 2. It's a 5 percentage point fall. So there was that effect in China. It's not hard to understand because China is a major exporter. And when demand spending, you know, in Europe, in the U.S. is declining, that's going to affect Chinese exports.
Okay.
And that's largely what happened. I mean, also, from everything I know, there was a very big rise in China in unemployment. Okay? You don't see that in official statistics because they don't count people unemployed in the countryside as unemployed, and they don't count people from the countryside working in the cities who don't have jobs as unemployed. But if you use like Western-style measures of unemployment, it seemed to have kept going up. Now, in response to this, the Chinese government went on a lending spree, you know, or they directed a lot of funds through state banks, which has led to a huge real estate boom or bubble. And I think it's a bubble. And for I'm not the only one. I mean, for a few years now, everybody's looking for this bubble to deflate. You know, you should go onto YouTube or somewhere. CBS did this documentary about, like, these cities, and they've got entire cities, small cities in China. Nobody's living in these homes, you know, and working people and middle-class people are buying these homes, putting their savings into these homes, and borrowing to purchase these homes, okay? They're not going to be able to resell them, you know, for what they paid at, down the road. So something's looking like it's going to give. Will they have an economic crisis Western style? We'll see. I don't know. You know, I read Martin Wolf's view is no, they won't have that, but they're still going to have serious troubles because, you know, you throw money into the construction of stuff and the purchase of stuff that just sits there. You know, that's a waste, whether it comes all crashing down at once or not.
Thanks for the talk, Andrew. While agreeing with almost all of it, there's one question I'd like to raise, and that is Marxist theory says the two ways of getting out of the crisis. The one is devaluation of capital, which you didn't talk about, but I know you think that's the principal way, and so do I. But the second way is increasing the rate of exploitation of the working class. Now, I see from your book it's quite important for you to deny that this has happened in the US. But, you know, just looking around Europe, and particularly this country, it appears to be, anyway, quite a systematic attack on wages and the share of income going to the working class. And in a country like Greece, it's really extreme that people are living on pensions of grandfathers and so on. And obviously this isn't essential to your whole thesis, because even if they are reducing this share of the income going to the working class, it isn't actually sufficient to change the general rate of profit, as you point out. But I'm just wondering, are you actually arguing that there hasn't been a fall in workers' income since the Great Recession? Or is your argument that it's only up to the Great Recession that you find that there's a constant ratio between the share of the social product going to the working class and the share to capital?
It's the latter. All of my points about, you know, underconsumption, falling wages, and not existing, so not being a cause, all of that was about pre-recession, okay? So, you know, causes come before effects. So what's happening now is different, but that it doesn't have anything to do with the causes of the recession. I do not mean to deny at all. I would not deny that right now we have, in a certain sense, increased exploitation of the working class. Certainly in Greece, it's striking and very tragic, but also in the U.S., workers' share of the product has fallen substantially in the space of a few years, since 2009. It's gone down a lot, whereas it did not for decades beforehand. And by the way, in the audience is Albin Söderqvist, and he has done really good, innovative work on looking at workers' share in what I think is a reasonable manner in Europe, South Korea, Japan, United States, Canada, lots of different countries in Europe. And he's found that in many of these countries, such as the UK, it seems that the general trajectory of worker share was similar to the US. In some places like South Korea, it went up and then came down a bit. Belgium, worker share did not go down. In other places, it went down. Netherlands, France, Germany. So it's a very mixed bag. Ireland, it was a very mixed bag. But certainly in the United States, it's gone down since 2009. But I want to make clear why that's the case. It's not that the wages and benefits per hour of workers have gone down after inflation. They haven't gone up much, but they've been stable. What has really gone on during the last several years in the U.S. is, okay, the recession is over technically, so production is going up, okay? So there's an increase in production, but the workforce hasn't increased. So they're managing to produce more with the same or slightly larger workforce, okay? And that means then, as a consequence, even though the workers who are employed are getting paid, you know, per hour the same, they're getting a decreasing share of what's produced. Is that important to reviving capitalism? Yes. Will it be sufficient? I don't know. I don't think so. Because there's a limit to that. And investment spending by businesses, factory construction and stuff like that, it's forward-looking. So you say, okay, well, we're doing this now. Well, yeah, but we got this, like, you know, plant and we got all this equipment and it's going to be producing stuff for 30 years to come. It's got to be profitable for 30 years to come. And we can't keep this, you know, high profits of the last several years up just by squeezing the workers forever. So they're very reticent. That's why there's all this cash of companies piling up in the banks. They're reticent to invest in structures and equipment and all of that because their expectations of the future are still not where they were prior to the recession.
Anybody else? Okay, yes.
Do you think that capitalism system is sowing the seeds of its own destruction? Will it do it on its own? Can it do it on its own? You know, you'll say that capitalism has its problems that capitalism are causing these problems. It's inherent in the system.
Yeah.
Is it enough to cause a total destruction of capitalism?
There are signs of that. I mean, especially ecological damage might cause the destruction of capitalism and civilization as we know it. You know, it might not come to that. But certainly, I think that there are tendencies in capitalism that are unstable. You know, it generates its crises from within itself. It's not external events. You know, it's not sunspots. It's not, you know, the stupid workers or anything like that that's causing this. I think that the problems of the system are those of the system, and they're, you know, you don't see these things in other societies. You go throughout most of human society, there was never an economic crisis such as we experience. Never. You would have droughts. You would have, you know, agricultural events. You know, so physical conditions would cause production to plummet. You know, you might have the Great Plague or something. So, you know, that would decimate the workforce and production would go down. But when you don't have, like, these natural events, but things like expectations of profit and the lack of payment of, you know, debt, and this is unprecedented in world history. This is, like, just totally new. It's endemic to the system, and it's... I don't know what more to say about it. It seems to me that's all I can really say.
Will the system eventually collapse economically? That was the question.
Oh, will it eventually collapse economically? I don't know. Let me say this. I have training as an economist, you know, and the public idea of an economist largely has to do with that of a forecaster. And the reason God invented economists is to make the weather forecasters look good. No, but seriously, there is nothing in economic theory, bourgeois economic theory, Marxian economic theory, there is nothing in economic theory that allows us to forecast the future with any reliability. There are a few technical tricks that people pick up that, like, basically anybody could pick up, which are all based on, well, let's assume that the future is like the present or the immediate past, more or less. That's the basic tricks. But there's nothing in economic theory that can allow you to predict the future. You can get a read on it. An historian can do so well as well. But the people who tell you, you know, here, I'm going to tell you what's happening in the future, you really shouldn't believe much of that. It's not based on much. Let me say that in principle, there is no final crisis of capitalism. Capitalism can always regenerate. In principle. That doesn't mean in reality. In other words, you have a big economic crisis. In principle, they can always come out of that. In principle, it might lead to a revolution. In principle, it might lead to, you know, just a complete mess and a collapse. It could lead to warlordism. It could lead to fascism. All kinds of things are possible in the political realm as responses. But in principle, capitalism can always regenerate. Because when there's a big economic downturn, that itself creates the conditions for regeneration. Businesses go bankrupt. New people come up and buy the companies. They buy them up cheaply. They don't have to pay the other people's debts. So their rate of profit is going to be a lot higher because they're not saddled with the debt and because they bought these companies at fire sale prices, you know, and all kinds of other conditions like that. So that's like the devaluation of capital or the destruction of capital that takes place in an economic crisis. So there is a process whereby capitalism itself goes into these crises and it gets out of by itself of these crises, but it's by no means automatic and it's by no means assured, but it is always possible.
Is the income that is going to its growth is going to increase? Income that has
some
growth, is it going to increase the same? And what is the reason?
Is world income per person going to increase? Or the growth rate of world income going to increase? Or something? I don't know. I've just said my piece about making predictions. Right now, I mean, you know, it's a mixed bag in terms of growth. I mean, some countries in the Eurozone are not doing well. Germany's not doing too badly. You know, Greece is falling apart. Is there a referendum today?
Yes.
Yeah.
Still going on.
Still vote. You know, the fate of the world economy to some extent might be hanging on what happens in this vote. I think things are very hard to predict. And I think they're very hard to predict because when you least expect it from where you least expect it, all of a sudden then you have a new financial disturbance. And the point that I began with is the next financial disturbance might be as big or even worse, have worse consequences than the one before. So, I don't even want to worry about like what I think the 20-year trajectory is because I don't know that anything that one could come up with by thinking about that would lead anywhere.
Okay. Did you say that the working class, that the working class in America hadn't seen a pay rise since the 70s? Did you say that their wage didn't actually really to a recession in 2008. Can you just confirm yes or no with that?
The working class has not seen a pay rise since the 1970s.
Yes, from the school economics. But anyway,
Wait a minute. I've looked at these numbers, and you can't just state something like that as a fact. Okay?
All right. Anyway.
No. This is a big issue. Let me tell you something about the underconsumptionists and people like them, like you know, the trade union bureaucrats and their think tanks, pump out a lot of very dubious information for very clear political reasons, and it's misleading at best. So, like when they say like the real wages, the after-inflation wages of workers haven't risen or have stagnated. Okay, I want to show you how that statistic gets produced. First of all, when you say after-inflation or real wages, that depends on how you're measuring the rate of inflation, and there's a lot of different ways of doing that, and they choose the one that gives you the biggest inflation so as to make the real wage growth look the least. And the measure of inflation they use is not a consistent series over time. So, like, researchers don't use that, you know. Researchers use a consistent series, and you get different results that way. Please let me finish. Secondly, that statistic refers to wages of so-called production and non-supervisory workers. So there's a lot of working class people who are not counted in those figures. Third, probably most importantly, you know, and you said pay, that figure is for wages and salaries excluding all benefits, excluding health care, insurance provided by employers, pension contributions of employers for employees, and in the United States, the government pension and health care system for retirees, Social Security and Medicare, half of the payments of taxes on the workers' behalf is from their employers. You know, so like when I was working, I would pay X percent, my employer would pay X percent into Social Security and into Medicare. Okay, now you count all those benefits along with the cash wages and benefits received now immediately, not at the time of retirement, and you get a very different picture. And there what you get is a not insignificant rise in the hourly compensation of employees and a stable share received by them in the business sector and in the corporate sector from 1970 to 2007. Okay, now, as for the second part of your question, please repeat it.
Sorry, yeah. Did you say that this the fact that the working class wages had stagnated had enough to do with the actual recession?
No, I didn't say, I'm not going to say that at all, because I'm not going to admit that working class wages stagnated, because they didn't.
Okay, well, they certainly got a massive, health got more expensive, and education was cut, and resources to basic benefits were also slashed during the 80s dramatically, which would be automatically, in anyone's mind, a cut in living standards, which is a cut in wealth, and would lead to a very poor group of people who were then given the offer of a very cheap mortgage and then would snap that idea up with a cheap mortgage because having no money and no actual pay increase would buy into that wholeheartedly, which would then lead totally to the actual recession in 2008.
There is so much misinformation in the story you've just told.
I could say the same to you.
Okay. Well, I would like you then to challenge one or more of my figures, and we can talk about that. I would rather do that than try to do to deconstruct everything you just said, like I did with what you said about wages. Would you like to challenge the accuracy of something I said?
I will do. I'll email you.
No, I mean, this is the main question that's been made, isn't it? Whether, in fact, working class living standards in America did fall in the last in the 30 or so years from the 70s onwards. And some people say yes, some people say no.
Well, actually, even the underconsumptionists say that the consumption levels did not fall, or the share of the product that went to consumption did not fall. But their argument, such as it is that that's only because, you know, people started to borrow more, despite stagnant wages and the declining share, to keep up their standard of living. But the data don't bear that out.
But I mean, it's only anecdotal, but I imagine that most people in this room are better off now than they were in 1970. But anyway, that's... Anybody else got any...
Some of them weren't even alive in 1970.
Well, okay.
Yes. With these under-consumptionist theories, what comes to mind is that hitherto economists have only interpreted the world. The point is that capitalism. The point is to replace it. The idea I get from those on the left who claim this under-consumptionist theory put forward is that there's nothing wrong with capitalism that can't be cured by getting rid of the capitalists and putting us in charge. And, you know, as far as like, we in the Socialist Party are concerned, we've got this old phrase that says, you know, imagining you can run capitalism in the interest of workers. It's like imagining you can run an abattoir in the interest of the animals it slaughters. You know, the system is based on employment, which is the French word for use. You know, and we are used up
yeah.
as human beings in the productive process. We are treated as things. You know, and I always, you know, what inspires me is a couple of passages from Mark Twain in the Paris manuscripts and one in the Communist Manifesto, which says, in place of the old bourgeois society, with its classes and class antagonism, we should have an association where the condition for the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all. And surely, as people who claim to be socialists, that's what we should be fighting for, not to patch up capitalism. Yeah, and while I'm at it, while I'm on it, I appreciate the fact that when you refer to workers, you refer to workers as regular workers. Whereas what you have in the picture you were doing about why workers are only, rather than confront their problems, they're only asking for a few more crumbs, you know, with corporate union, with business unionism. Now, the problem with capitalism, to reproduce itself, it has to produce a class consciousness, a ruling class consciousness and a working class consciousness. Now, we are conditioned as a working class to become employees, to become servants. So therefore, we have to become conditioned to accept servile consciousness. And of course, that means we have to be humbled. And humble people don't make revolution. And that's why, you know, you hear lots and lots of working people when referring to themselves. They rabbit, they parrot rather, what they've been conditioned to understand themselves to be as ordinary people. Because whenever a corporate politician, an academic, people with power and influence, whenever they refer to workers, the class that does everything necessary to reproduce society, they're just ordinary people. And therefore, those people calling them ordinary people, those with the money and the power, therefore must be extraordinary. And we allow those people to interpret our lives for us, to tell us what to eat, how to think, who to be. And of course, you know, we have to, you know, those of us who've seen through that, have to try and encourage our fellow workers to wake up to the real importance, the extraordinary nature of life and human beings.
Sorry.
Do you think there is...
Can we back here what he's saying? Can you all hear what he's saying?
Can you hear in the back what the man in front is saying?
Okay, I'm just asking whether you think that there is a link between the sort of economic sort of trajectory and class struggle. Or do you think that the class struggle has sort of is a manifestation of sort of other factors as well as the sort of response of the working class to their sort of economic situation?
Let me say something about the first thing, and then
you'd agree with that. Second.
Yeah, I mean, in general, I fully agree with what you said. And I think it's a very important point to focus on the insufficiency of this idea of, you know, all we need to do is get rid of those people and put in different people and have the same thing in terms of a system and the way it works, but things are going to be better because we have different faces in control. Marx talked a lot about the capitalists being personifications of capital. And that comes from the Greek drama where you'd have an actor or actress and they would have a character mask. You know, they'd be playing a part. And that's what anybody is who is a capitalist. It's not like a kind of person. It's a person playing a social role. And different people come in and they play that social role. And they can be, you know, members of the government. They can be on the Politburo. You know, they can even be, you know, in a workers' council. As long as the economic laws of the system are in control, they are operating according to the dictates of the system as much subjectively as they would like to break free of that. And Marx had an interesting case because there was a pottery manufacturer, Wedgwood, in his day. Say what?
Josiah
Wedgwood, yeah, you know, Wedgwood, China and stuff. And he was very concerned about child labor and overwork and so forth. And he wanted Parliament to limit the working day. But he said, look, I can't do it. You know, I'm part of the system. And if I were to do it on my own, you know, I would just go out of business. So, you know, we need to have a change in the character of the system. Now, that's a limited change in the character of the system, but it's an important point, I think, and Marx highlighted it. I use the term regular workers to contrast that with, like, CEOs when you're looking at employee compensation statistics. You know, there's the CEOs and the regular workers. I didn't mean to disparage anybody, but I do apologize.
No,
yeah.
I congratulate you.
No, no, yeah.
I hate the idea. I really wince every time I hear a worker described as ordinary.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
It's ordinary.
Yeah,
ordinary means of no account.
Yeah,
yeah. No, no speciality.
Okay.
You know,
yeah, but Danny, you don't understand it. The American for ordinary is regular. But
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Whatever. It's hard. I understand the problem. Do I think there's a link between the economic trajectory and the politics? Yeah. Do I think politics is fully determined by the economic trajectory? No. But there's a link. Certainly, I do think that there has been an increase in class struggles and economic struggles since the crisis. Clearly, in Spain, in Greece, in the United States, we had the battles in Wisconsin. And Occupy, which to some extent had an economic character, began, you know, in New York. Our problem is not that. The problem is that the struggles are getting co-opted. And they're moving into channels that are being driven by, you know, like the left wing of the Democratic Party or even the Obama administration, or, you know, railing against the 1% instead of being directed at the system. And, you know, Occupy really didn't have anything to say about employment. In terms of, like, housing in the United States, we've had a huge problem of people losing their homes. The only thing Occupy had to say about that was that some of the foreclosures were illegal, and we should not allow, you know, illegal foreclosures, but what about all the legal ones? Basically, the thinking of the key person behind the Occupy, probably, I mean, he wasn't like a mastermind, but, you know, probably the foremost theoretician, an anarchist named David Graeber, although he's an anarchist, his economics is firmly based in the state. I mean, he's a Keynesian of the kind that says, you know, you spend more and that creates growth, and that allows you to, like, as a government, spend even more, and it's just like you're on this perpetual motion machine. By the government borrowing, it's going to create this perpetual motion of growth. It's a really kind of low-level crude Keynesianism. It's kind of amazing to have somebody say he's an anarchist, but, like, his solution for the crisis is plain old state-led Keynesianism. I think those are among our problems, and not the spontaneous reactions and fight back and attempt to keep up standard of living. I think, you know, people are aware of their situation, and they don't want to give up, and they don't want to lose what they've had. But the left has not, like I said, been doing the job that it needs to do, is to meet people's questions and disgust and apprehensions regarding the nature of this system. All of the the discourse of the left is, you know, we'll get you a bigger piece or something like that. I think that's really bad. I mean, opinion polls show a really favorable attitude towards socialism, whatever that might mean, because it's an opinion poll. They don't really say, you know, much more than do you like socialism. But in the United States, especially among black people and young people.
Okay, yes. Somebody else has got a question. Okay.
Would you say that state-run systems are less prone to economic crisis? Systems such as Russia's?
Did I say that?
No. Would you say that?
No. And I would not say that at all. I would say that sometimes the crises take different forms. And it's kind, you know, the normal commercial crises, you know, like you might not have that, or a normal debt crisis you might not have, like in China. Right now, I was talking about the Chinese government basically fostering a bubble to overcome the slump in exports and so forth. You know, a lot of building and stuff that they've engaged in to overcome that. You know, the state banks might be able to just ignore the fact that the debts are not being repaid. You know, not recognize, to use the accounting term, not recognize the unpaid debts. But the effects are there. The effects of that are there in any case. So the problems may take a different form. And so you might not have, like, a collapse of the Chinese banking system. You might have, you know, decades of slow growth or something. It you know, different systems lead to different ways in which these things get expressed, different ways of making capitalism function. But I've never seen a legitimate argument that I find legitimate that you could, like, you know, get rid of these problems just rather than making them take a different form in one version rather than another. I mean, I'm open to such arguments, but I've just not heard one.
Okay.
Slightly different tack, just a question. The Marx says in the 11th thesis on Feuerbach that philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. It's necessary to change it. Could you just say a bit about what the Marxist humanist organization is doing to actually change the world, or are you simply seeing yourself as a educational organization?
Right.
You need to explain, perhaps.
I work with Marxist Humanist Initiative, which is the successor organization to the organization founded by Raya Dunevskaya, who founded the philosophy of Marxist humanism in the U.S. Now, the version of the 11th thesis of Feuerbach that you quoted is Engels' version, and it includes the word only that is not in Marx's own text. Marx says the philosophers have interpreted the world in various ways. The point, however, is to change it, or the point is to change it. You know, only interpret makes that a disparaging remark. I don't want to get too much into the issue of exactly what that means. Clearly, if you look at Marx's life, his trajectory was not that of rejecting the interpretation of the world. You know, I mean, he's interpreting the history of capitalism, the factors that drive capitalism, the future of capitalism. I mean, all of that is interpretation. I mean, all of empirical investigation is interpretation of the brute facts that we observe. So I don't think one should disparage interpretation. I think he was simply saying that there's a point to all this. So I think what is unique to Marxist humanism is the idea of let me say what we in Marxist Humanist Initiative emphasize, based on Dunevskaya's philosophy, is the two-way road, the dual rhythm of revolution, the destruction of the old, but also the creation of the new. And the understanding that, you know, we think that people who live horrible lives in this system are unfree, have aspirations for a different life. And that arises spontaneously. Okay, that doesn't need to come to them and be imported to them. So we reject all of that Kautsky thing that Lenin inherited. But once you say that, then there's the issue of, well, what's going to replace this? You can't replace something with nothing. You know, you can't just say, let's get rid of these horrible people who are, you know, bloodsuckers, and then we'll live free and everything will be fine. We live in an economic system. You have to have a different economic system. You can't have nothing. And we think that that, first of all, problem is very important to work out, and we're trying to work that out because we think that the lack of a fully detailed, coherent answer to what can replace capitalism and be a real replacement rather than revert back to the same thing, because we don't have that kind of an answer fully worked out in a credible way yet, that is holding back the trajectory of freedom struggles to some extent. We also think that it's very important that despite the fact that people have this, you know, aversion to the system that comes from their conditions of life and they have aspirations for something new, we need more than that spontaneous struggle. The minds of the oppressed are crucial. And the minds of the oppressed are crucial because we are going to have the same old shit, to quote Marx, if we have this allegedly new system, but your regular people are not yet intellectually and theoretically prepared to govern society themselves, every man, woman, and child. Okay? If they don't have that ability, they are going to have to hand over power to some elite. And I don't make predictions, you know, generally, but I don't see how that elite would not turn into a new ruling class. Okay? So one of the key things that we have to do is to develop the class, to develop the regular so-called people, so that they can run society themselves. And so I judge everything, you know, by whether it helps to empower them, to give them confidence in their ability, and to build their abilities to understand and to develop themselves and to run things themselves. You know, so for instance, on this like issue of like $15 an hour minimum wage in the U.S., yeah, well, I'm in favor of it, okay? But it's one thing when it's a program coming from the labor bureaucracy. It would be different if it were coming from below. But we work on that, and we put that issue out there. We're very small, so we can't materially affect events on the ground at this moment, you know? I mean, the entire U.S. left, no matter how well organized it is, like, can't prevent a war from taking place, right? And we certainly don't have that kind of power to, you know, mount demonstrations that are going to, like, you know, occupy the Pentagon or anything like that. Okay, so we do what we can, but we are concerned with the ongoing intellectual development of the movement from practice and to meet it at its highest levels. That is our particular contribution, I think.
Sounds a bit like us. Excellent.
Yeah, we echo William Morris when he said that you can't have socialism without socialists. I mean, the means have to be put in, as power must, as Tom Paine said, the power must fit the purpose. And the other thing, if we have a socialist society, we can have to have a society where we're true to ourselves. And all societies are social relationships. So it follows logically that the more we know about what we're relating with and who we're relating to, the more functional, the more human that relationship will be. Well, if we take a look at the genetics and paleoarchaeology, what that will tell us undoubtedly that we all share the same ancestors. In fact, you know, there's a female human, early human called mitochondrial Eve, and there's a male early human called chromosome 11. And we can all trace our ancestry back to these two individuals. They lived at different times, but nevertheless, we can trace our ancestors back to them. So therefore, in a sense, we are a family. So if we are to be true of ourselves as a human family, then it's necessary to bring according to ability and take according to our needs. Now, what attracted me to socialism is it's so simple. And therefore, it can be expressed not only simply, but honestly. So therefore, if we want an honest society, we have to create that society honestly, which means the only way to do that is democratically. And when we talk about democracy, we talk about a society where all socially relevant information is freely available to all. Where you don't need leaders, because everybody has the information. And leaders, well, they need very special things. They need privileged information, and they need followers. The followers of people who don't know where they're going. And leaders patronise workers. You know, the left is monstrous in patronising the working class.
What is it, Mullen?
I mean, I think you're right, but on the issue of democracy, I think it's a means. It's a good means, but we have to be aware that as long as the system remains capitalist, democracy cannot contravene the laws of capitalism. Ultimately, I'm not saying that you said that, but a lot of people think, okay, here's how you get socialism. You know, you either by violence conquer political power, or you vote in a change in the government, and then you raise your hand. How many people want a new society where we produce for needs? And, you know, okay, so we got a majority, and then you declare that we're producing for needs. And, yeah, well, how do you make that happen? Have you actually broken with the laws of capitalism that mean that you have to produce efficiently at low cost to compete? You know, and so forth. In other words, if you know, in capitalism, you have a workplace, and they decide we're going to produce for needs. You know, well, that might not be profitable. You know, something that doesn't produce for human needs, like in the financial sector, might be more profitable. So, profit calls the tune, and you know, I mean, people need, you know, milk in the third world and so forth. And, you know, it's just not going to be profitable. Other things are going to be profitable that people don't need. So there are these laws of capitalism that are in control. And, you know, voting and declaring by itself is not a solution, although I'm totally for democracy. I'm not one of these people who criticizes democracy. I'm just saying by itself it's not a solution. There have to be economic solutions to these economic problems.
But, I mean, if I can come back on that one briefly. I mean, we see capitalism as a global system that has to be replaced globally.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, unless socialism properly, you know, properly constituted and well explained, well, I can't see how any reasonable people would, you know, would, apart from like the nonsense about human nature, would reject it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and Marx pointed out where the power lies in society. It lies with the workers.
Yeah.
The workers do everything. Well, as a majority, once the workers decide that they want to live in a different way, to, you know, create different things and produce a different society, as a majority, there's not really a power on earth that can stop them. They'll just carry on doing stuff. I mean, you know, even the armed forces, the police, they're all workers in uniform, and they're not immune to this I mean, what I'm not considered like the most inspiring idea I've ever discovered in my life, but it, you know, inspired Marx when he learned it from the French workers in Paris. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the potential in socialism is absolutely stunning. Once we create critical mass, then the growth will be exponential, you know, because
right.
I lost it.
But we're going to see a good example of democracy and economic laws in the result of this Greek referendum. They might vote for no to austerity, but the economic laws of capitalism will will negate that vote. So, I mean, it's not the point you're trying to make. You can't overcome the economic laws of capitalism by...
In one country.
But even I mean, I hate to take these really speculative examples, but let's say there's no, quote, capitalist class and the workers have, quote, taken power. Okay, so we don't have, quote, capitalism. What do we have? Okay, this is why I come back to this issue. You can't replace something with nothing. Okay, and so just saying the workers decide and society is in their interest, that's not a sufficient answer to how we can have a modern society where we are all interrelated, producing for one another. So, you know, we get our supplies from, you know, some other country, and what we produce goes to some third place still, and they're using that to provide something still elsewhere. How do we have a complex network, very sophisticated like this, that does not run either according to a state plan from above or this bizarre kind of market system, you know, and is not driven by profit and self-expansion of value? Just saying that the workers will decide, what will they decide, and how can we know or have confidence that what they decide will not lead to a reversion back to the same thing or even something worse? I think that there probably are good answers to these questions, but they are questions that have to be asked.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as I said before, you can't have socialism without socialism. So what I meant by that was people who were conscious of their position in society and the kind of society they wanted to create democratically, collectively, and aware of the duties and responsibilities. They were prepared to take up those duties and responsibilities. So therefore, if we have a majority of people like that, I really don't see the problem, because if we can run, as we do, capitalism in the interest of a parasitic class, mm-hmm. then I'm sure we can run a much simpler system. I mean, you know, producing for use to meet human need rather than producing for profit, a much simpler system. I'm sure we can run that kind of system in our own interest without too much problem.
Okay, you've got your question.
Yeah, I'd like to say something on the voting. Because we don't see that you can vote the ending of capitalism just like that. You know, you can't. You can do it if you first have the class conscious, the understanding of the necessary majority of people. In the first place, understanding that capitalism has outlived its usefulness, that capitalism has to end, and understanding what it is that you want to put in place. And that is, as Danny said, the producing simply things to be used as to meet needs. And in that case, you didn't vote for the end of capitalism. Oh, right, now we voted for the end of it. What are we going to do? You've got to be formulating how you're going to run things while those ideas are growing before you get to the necessary level of with the ability then to use the vote to actually make the change. So it's got to be that knowledge of what you're going to do, the voting, and this is the way that it can be done so that it is a non-violent, peaceful changeover, because it's in everyone's interest to make the change, even those that are going to lose their privileged position in society. They, in a sense, they have nothing to use. They can join in with the different kind of society with the rest of us, and they are regular people as well. You know, they're not all some we might dislike more than others, but then they might be some of our fellow workers that we aren't so keen on as the others. But the point is to use Parliament to send delegates, not representatives, but delegates to do the bidding of those that are sending them to do the voting, to enact the abolition of capitalism, to lock off all the coercive financial elements of the system, make use of the things that can continue. And the quick things, well, you want the streets to be lit, you want all sorts of things to happen. So you lock off all of the useless things. The Department of Agriculture does some useful work besides all the work that's tied up with the economics and the politics. But you make use of the organisations that are there. You have people in every strata of the society who are going to be putting in their ideas, already making the changes. We're not going to make these things anymore, this useless stuff. We're not going to make bombs and guns anymore. We're only going to make things useful to human beings. And if you go to get to the voting stage, which is crossing the T's and dotting the I's, then you do have ready your formulation of how the society can be run after the ending of capitalism.
and I haven't got much time. I want to.
I was interviewed in Socialist Standard, and on this issue of a peaceful, that's the publication. Yeah. What I said was not very profound, but just important to what I said. It seems to me that the key issue, and I think the questioner would agree with it, the person who interviewed me, would agree with what I said, and I'm about to repeat the question of how, you know, will the revolutionary change be violent or peaceful? The degree to which it's peaceful depends, I think, principally on how successful we are in talking to just the regular grunts in the military and getting them to point their guns in the other direction. You know, in every successful revolution, you know, the police and the military go to the other side. I think that is actually very important, and not just that, but like people like the Edward Snowdens and stuff, the techies. The economic tasks that we face are not, I believe, principally issues of what do we want to produce, although that's important, what do we not want to produce, you know, what do we want more of, what do we want less of. Those are important, but I don't think those are really the key economic problems that beset or would beset socialism as against capitalism. There are other issues of coordination. Like I was saying, we get our stuff from somewhere and it goes to somewhere for third place and so forth. Engels and then others had this idea that all the problems of economics had become simplified as part of the social second international thinking of you know, the anarchy of capitalism going by the boards, and we've got administration, we got management. So he said, you know, all the problems have become just problems of administration, you know, and a worker with a pocket calculator. He didn't say worker with a pocket calculator, but a worker with a pocket calculator can, you know, manage the economy. To me, that is just like really wishful thinking. There are problems of coordination and there are problems of incentives. And we're all part of the human race, but one of the things about the human race is there is self-interest, you know, underlying this species, and we have to grapple with issues of self-interest. And we can't expect that revolutionary fervor or this feeling of goodwill that we're all in it together is going to overcome our problems. You know, that can work for maybe a few weeks in Barcelona, you know, or in Paris in 1871. The system has to deliver the goods, be able to deliver the goods, improve people's well-being pretty damn quickly, or they're going to sour on it and have every reason to do so. So we're going to have to be able to make people's lives better and know how to do that, and not just what we want, but how we're going to accomplish that.
Anybody else got anything? Oh, yes.
Thank you for your valued conversation, discussion. But 1904, we've been around Socialist Party of Great Britain, SDGB. If you haven't got these, please have a look. Not being patronising, but it'll answer all those questions you've said. From capitalism to socialism, socialism as a capital alternative. And lovely covers, it's the inside.
If that's what I say, I think. Okay, Danny.
Well, I'm quite surprised because you're differentiating, like, human beings from the system. You're talking about the system. Well, you see, whereas you've got the capitalist system and you've got workers, well, you have your socialist system, which will be the workers. And as I said before, you know, all societies are social relationships, so the more you know about what you relate with, who you're related to, what that means is you'll be getting rid of a very important factor in socialism, which is alienation. And instead of having social alienation, what you will have in socialism, what you must have if it's to operate, is you'll have social intimacy. where people are far more aware of not only who they are as members of society, but as everybody else in society. And of course, once you have that, you have a common identity. Now, the great thing about a common identity, along with a common interest, the great thing about this common identity is that you cannot exploit, coerce, oppress, or stitch up or abuse those people that you identify with. Because then you're essentially harming yourself. And as we all know, it's very simple. You know, an injury to one is an injury to all. So that's what we'll need before we can have a socialist society. We'll have to have this zeitgeist, if you like, without sounding too pretentious, this spirit of the time, of social intimacy.
But, do you want to continue, or do you want to...
Let's have a cup of tea.
Okay, well, thank you again.
And can I respond to that?
Of course, sorry, yes. In fact, you can sum up altogether.
No, I can't sum up altogether. I'll let people sum up for themselves.
Okay.
What you want is what I want. What you're seeming to say will guarantee that this takes place is a certain consciousness or way of looking at things. I think that social consciousness is determined by social being rather than the reverse. So what will create the consciousness that you want that will guarantee this is the actual facts on the ground are conducive to that. Like, they're not right now. I mean, right now, you know, people have individual interests and there is no general social interest. What will create a general social interest and then people who have that general social interest is a society where you don't have economic laws that generate antagonisms, and we do have to work out that problem and not just leave it to, you know, people's minds are going to change.
We can answer it upstairs.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you for a collection of £50, 81
pence. £51, 81
pence, wasn't it? Well, it says 50 pounds, correct. If you want to put an extra pound in. And as I mentioned, that we've got a copy of the Socialist Standard and the interview with Andrew as well, and also, as it just came up at the end, our pamphlet, Socialism, a Practical Alternative, which goes into these problems of coordination and so on, which we'll give you a signed copy in thanks.
I will purchase my signed copy.
But talk about purchasing, Andrew's brought along various publications here. Can Income Redistribution Rescue Capitalism? No. Capitalist Crisis, a Debate, and his book on the failure of capitalist production. So,
and if you, the online flyers there?
Oh, sorry, these things, yeah. If you want to follow the course on capital, they're all here. Right, and now thanks for turning up, and now we can... Oh, thanks for speaking.
Thank you very much.